I think many of you know that my newest book, Zen Heart, is now out and available. And it's a little bit different from my first two books, because my first two books were really based on 50 or so Dharma talks that I had given over a several year period. And then I kind of loosely strung them together and made them into a book, which they actually divided up into two books. But it was never originally based on a theme that I was trying to present. It was more based on the talks themselves, kind of loosely strung together. This book, Zen Heart, started with a central theme and was carried all the way through. And the central theme is what I want to talk about a little bit today. I've mentioned many, many times here that when I first started spiritual practice, I had one very strong motivation, and that motivation was to be free from the discomfort of anxiety and the discomfort of fear, which was so much a part of my life. And I really believe that if I practiced very intensely, particularly if I really practiced intensely with the breath, focusing on the breath, that the fear would just be taken care of, that I would be able to get rid of it. I also had the hope, I don't know where it came from, but I had the hope and very strong belief that with one single, very clear, what you could call enlightened experience, that things would be forever clarified. That, in other words, that the rest of my difficulties also would go away. Now, since then, and particularly since I became a Zen teacher, I've seen many, many students begin practice with the same illusions that I've had. There's the hope there that, particularly the hope that there can be some very quick solution or some very single purpose solution to our difficulties. And so we have a lot of impatience, thinking practice should be taking care of our troubles more quickly than it's doing. Like I've already been practicing 2 or 3 years and I still have this or that or the other thing. So many students begin practice with this belief that practice is going to fairly quickly, and by just doing some simple thing like following the breath or labeling thoughts or whatever your practice is, that it's going to take care of it. Many people also begin hope with the practice that maybe if they could have that one really big enlightenment experience, that would just take care of it just right then and there without having to do anything else. The problem is, there are no shortcuts in practice. See, it's not that practice is so terribly complex, because it's really not that complex. But what's problematic is when we hope for one either simplistic or instantaneous solution to what we see as our problems, to our life difficulties. Nonetheless, we can talk about what practice is and what practice isn't. And over the years of practice, I've come to the conclusion that there are really three essential phases in practice that we all have to address. And my purpose in writing the book, Zen Heart, was to try and clarify very explicitly what these three phases that we all have to go through are, and also how they interweave, to allow the process of waking up, to allow the process to happen. You might wonder why I chose these particular three, because it's true, there are many, many different ways to slice the pie of reality. And the reason I chose these particular three is because all of us have to deal with these processes on an inner level. And from my experience and from observing other people, each of us has to go through the explicit inner process that each of these three phases kind of represents. There are no fixed or distinct dividing lines between each of these three phases. They do interweave. However, again, the inner process that we have to go through has to be addressed individually. And that's what I'm going to be talking about a little bit this morning. The problem is when we either downplay one of these phases on our spiritual journey, or even worse, if we ignore one completely, what's going to happen is our spiritual maturity, or our, if you want to call it progress, or our spiritual development is going to remain short-circuited. So the reason I'm talking about these, the reason I wrote about these three phases, because I think it really helps if we could have a really clear view of what it is that we have to be dealing with. If we have a clear view of what these three phases are, if we have a clear view of what the actual inner process that we need to be going through, it makes the whole really sometimes daunting effort of trying to wake up, it makes it a little bit more workable and a little bit more straightforward. So the first phase, which we've talked about many, many times here, is the me phase of practice. And in the me phase, what we're doing is paying particular attention to all the ways that we're run by our self-centered minds. So what this involves is looking at our all of our self-centered thoughts. It involves looking at and working with our various ways of reacting emotionally, our various strategies of behavior. Basically, all of the me stuff, all of the stuff that makes up most of our lives. One of the things we have to remember that working in the me phase of practice, it's not a philosophical inquiry. It's not a theoretical process. It actually has to be very specific. It has to be very empirical. So, for example, knowing what the mind is believing involves knowing with a kind of precision and honesty the actual thoughts that we hold to, the thoughts that we're attached to and really believe in. This does not mean that we have to go back into our psychological history and uncover our past in the mistaken belief that we could discover why we do things the way we do. In fact, working in the me phase, if we could throw out the whole concept of why am I doing this, we would be better off. It's not about analyzing. The work done in the me phase is really an objective process. We're really just observing the content of the mind, both the mind of thoughts, the mind of emotions, and then eventually, and particularly, working with the mind that's so much rooted in fear, being able to clearly see the particular fears that run each of us. Eventually, in the me phase of practice, as most of you know, we have to move from the relatively straightforward process of objectively observing our emotions and fears to the process of residing in them, which means to actually being able to feel them as the physical experience in the body, the visceral experience of what it means to be caught in an emotion or a fear. This is not something that we're used to before we come to practice, and we may have very little interest in doing it because the fact is when we come face to face with our difficult emotions, and particularly when we get closer to the bone, like dealing with sadness or loneliness or deep disappointment or fear, it's physically uncomfortable. It's physically, emotionally uncomfortable to experience these. And it makes sense that we're really not very interested in spending a lot of time there. This is the place where most students get stuck in the me phase of practice, because what happens is we end up wallowing in our emotional suffering, our emotional difficulties, rather than actually residing in it or experiencing it. But the difference between wallowing in an emotion and residing in emotion, it's vast, the difference between them, and it's also crucial that we understand what it is. Wallowing in an emotion means that we're still caught believing the thoughts. Residing in an emotion, on the other hand, is a non-conceptual experience. What it means is that we're feeling the physical experience of what our life is when we're caught in that emotion, but we're able to do it by dropping the storyline of our thinking. In fact, being able to drop the storyline of me with all of my stories is probably one of the most crucial aspects of the me phase of practice. So, for example, if we experience a little bit of fear or anxiety, like I certainly did when I was in the hospital with Elizabeth on Thursday, it's very easy to get caught in the thinking mind, having thoughts like, oh, this is really frightening, or what's going to happen? And then we're off in the mental spinning, and it's very easy to get caught and stuck in the emotional reaction that we're having in that moment. But if we're able to refrain from getting caught in that storyline, this is, again, the storyline of me, and instead just reside in, for example, for me, it was just a very faint quiver in the body. Just feel the quiver in the body. That's when we're able to experience our life in sense of residing in our life, or really being present with our life rather than indulging it or wallowing in it. And taking this one step further, truly residing in an emotion means that we're able to experience what's going on, not just as the physical sensations in the body, like in this example that I gave, there was a quiver in the center of the body, but also we're maybe able to take in a wider container of awareness. Like one of the things we teach here often is to be aware of the surrounding environment, or to be aware of sounds. And then within that kind of bigger container, you would feel what's happening in the body. The way that I worked with this on Thursday was using the wider container of the spaciousness of the heart, just breathing the sensations of this faint quiver of anxiety directly into the center of the chest and letting it be experienced on that level. When we experience our emotions on this level, and hopefully many of you know this at this point, no longer tied to the thinking mind, no longer believing the judgments about our experience, the experience that we're having can move from something that maybe originally was very solid, perhaps very dark, to simply energy. Just the simple energy of the experience, which is always more porous. It's not so solid anymore. And it definitely is experienced as something that is much more light rather than being heavy and dark. See, this is the paradox. I was talking to someone, maybe Bob, we were talking about this morning, that the paradox is that when we can bring our attention to this small sense of self, whatever it is that we're experiencing in the moment, the paradox is that that's an opening or a portal into a larger sense of self. By just paying attention to the exact present moment of our experience, no longer caught in the thinking part, but just the experience itself, that opens us up into a taste of reality. See, at this point, if we're able to experience on this level, we're already moving beyond the me phase of practice into the second phase of practice, which is called the phase of being awareness. But you should really be clear about this. We're never completely done with working in the me phase. There's always going to be some little remnant from our past, some little blind spot that we're just not seeing about ourselves, that's always going to come up at least periodically when we get close to some one of our own particular edges. So working in the me phase doesn't mean we work in the me phase and then we're done. It means we could spend a lot of time working here in the beginning years of practice, and then we'll still have to work with it somewhat, but now we're able to devote more of our attention and our time to working on the next two phases, the second phase of being awareness and the third phase of being kindness. So for the second phase, being awareness, most simply put, being awareness means we're able to experience a larger sense of what life is. And the essential movement in this phase is we go from the experience of ourselves in our life as I as a me, which is where most of us are most of the time. It's a very narrow experience of reality. Going from I as a me to the experience of I as awareness. It's a slow movement, it's a gradual movement, but it's a different way of perceiving reality. Again, it's a larger sense of what life is. Now, sometimes to experience and cultivate being awareness, we work on specific practices. In fact, you could start this in the very, very first day of practice. You don't have to wait till you're done with the me phase to be working on the second phase. For example, many of you do the practice of being aware of the breath. being aware of the breath is a practice in the sphere of being awareness, because we're taking one little step beyond the skin boundary of a me. And then you could like multiply this. For example, many of us do the practice of dual awareness, where we simultaneously bring awareness to breathing and then to the environment. And what we're doing with this is taking even a further step outside of the narrow confines of being a me and opening up to a little bit wider sense of reality. That's one of the reasons that Elizabeth and I emphasize cultivating the practice of the dual awareness practice of breath and environment so much, because a lot of the emphasis here for many years has been primarily on the me stuff, working with all our belief thoughts, working with our strategies, working with our fears. And sometimes we forget how important it is to, at the same time, be working on cultivating just a basic awareness of what life is. Okay, so in this second phase of being awareness, we could be working on specific practices like dual awareness. We could also be working on daily life practices of just cultivating awareness as we go through our day. So, for example, you could work on practices like when you're walking down the street, just being aware of your feet on the pavement. Or if you're looking at, you're walking around and you're looking at trees or at plants, you actually look at them and actually see them rather than being caught in daydreams, which is where our mind is most of the time. Or perhaps you could have the experience of when you're talking to another person and you're actually looking into their eyes and just seeing them as another person rather than seeing them in terms of what you could get from them or from your own particular agendas. See, when we practice these everyday practices, like just simple things, very mundane things, like just walking down the street and just being present, there's a particular experience, there's a kind of delight in just being here. The problem is, it's a very mundane experience, and for most of the time, we're kind of bored with doing practices like these, and it's very easy to get stuck in the belief that practice is really primarily about sitting on the cushion in meditation, cultivating particular states of awareness, like calmness or spaciousness or clarity. Or we could get caught in the other delusion that practice is primarily about dealing with our own particular problems so that we don't have them anymore. And because we could easily get lost, it's very common to forget about these simple mundane awareness practices in everyday life. The kind where we're just going through our day and just practicing being aware, again, of the trees, our feet, another person, without getting caught in the mind. See, whether we're cultivating this being awareness through doing specific meditation practices like the dual awareness practice, or through doing practices as we go through our day, like, say, being aware of our feet, there's one particular defining quality that happens during this phase, and that is that the sense of I, the sense of me, gradually begins to change over this period of time. We could actually experience a particular sense of being, or you could describe this as the visceral experience of being present, of just being here. See, when being awareness is activated, the sense of I does not disappear. The sense of being a me does not disappear, and it doesn't have to. But again, the sense of I moves from I as a me, which is a very narrow experience of reality, to the broader experience of I as awareness. The I in I as awareness is not a bigger version of me. Okay? It's not like you're developing, like I'll be developing a new and better version of Ezra. This sense of I is really something quite different, and it's very difficult to describe what this is, but one of the parameters is there's a kind of knowing. There's an inner experience of knowing who we are and knowing on a much clearer level what our life is when we move from the I as a me to the experience of I as awareness. See, the sense of an Ezra doesn't go away. There's still the experience that there's a body right here, there's a personality right here, there's thoughts being believed, but this can be experienced, the sense of I as awareness can be experienced knowing that there's more to this than just this body. There's more to this than just the thoughts, more to this than just the dramas that will in fact continue to go through. That's what the experience of, that's the cultivation that happens during the period of, or the phase of being awareness. So again, to be even more clear about this, the experience of being awareness, the experience of I as awareness, is not a magical state. It's not a mystical state. We're not talking about something where we disappear. I'm not talking about having peak or enlightenment experiences. I'm talking about the very basic experience of just being, of being present, of being here. What's interesting is that although this is a natural state of who we are, this experience of life, this being able to really just be, does not come to us naturally. It requires all the work first of working in the me phase of practice, where we clear out the debris of the mind that gets in the way of really being. And it also it requires an ongoing effort, a never-ending effort, to counteract the forces of sleep and mechanicalness, the forces that Needleman was talking about in the article that we just read. Okay, so the first phase is the me phase. The second phase is the phase of being awareness. The third phase is the phase of being kindness. And being kindness is about cultivating the awakened heart. It's connecting with the loving kindness or compassion that really are part of our true nature. It also involves learning to live from that place. And one thing I've come to appreciate over the years is that it really is necessary to cultivate this third phase as a necessary part of deepening our spiritual journey. It may come to us in parts naturally, just living more from compassion, living more from kindness, but it is also something that can be very definitively deepened by making specific efforts in this area. One of the ways we could work on this, and what many of you are doing now, we could do specific meditations, like the loving kindness meditation or the forgiveness meditation. But it's also possible to cultivate this third phase by just doing basic awareness practice, for example, of doing the practice of breathing in and out in the center of the chest. One of the aspects that we're encouraging many people to do. See, this is really no different a type of practice than being aware of the breath in the nose or of really listening to sounds. It's just cultivating a specific physical awareness quality of breathing in and out of the center of the chest. Why this works to cultivate being kindness is a mystery. I don't have an answer for this, but it's something that you could actually experience within yourself, that the practice of cultivating the breath into the center of the chest somehow breaks down the defenses that normally prevent us from connecting with the loving kindness or compassion that we are. The other way we could work with this, the practice of the breath into the chest, is through working with difficult emotions. For example, if we're experiencing intense loneliness or sadness, or if we're experiencing fear, even the little bit of fear that I was experiencing in the hospital on Thursday, you could feel those sensations, and then it's as if you're breathing those sensations directly into the chest center on the in-breath. And then you just breathe them in, and you don't need to do anything. You just breathe them in and feel them, and then just take a breath out. Working with our emotions in this way, again, allows us to experience the emotions within the spaciousness of the heart. And the development of cultivating being kindness allows us to experience them in a way where, when we're experiencing disappointment in ourselves or in our life, or experiencing fear, we no longer see them as defects, our own particular defects. We see them as just the conditioned being that we are, and that we could take them in and breathe them in with the kind of warmth or friendliness that in the past maybe we're never allowed to relate to ourselves in that way. I don't want to say anything else about the phase of being kindness at this point, other than to just give you one example of what it might look like to live from being kindness. There's a book that Somerset Maugham wrote maybe back in the 30s or 40s or whenever he wrote it. The book is called The Razor's Edge. And the main character in that book is a guy named Lawrence Durrell. And the character in the book is actually based on a real-life person who was, in fact, a spiritual seeker. And in Larry Durrell's spiritual seeking, he was able to have the clarity of seeing the one essential truth that we're capable of experiencing on the path, and that is the fact that all is one, that all is connectedness. And he also had the great fortune of being able to experience the other essential truth, which is that all is love. And when he experienced this, he came off the mountaintop, because he actually went off to the mountains in Tibet, and he came back to New York City, and instead of becoming a spiritual teacher, which he certainly could have become because he had great insight and compassion, he became a cab driver in New York City. And what he wanted to do from his own experience of just awakening the heart was to just give himself to other people without any kind of fanfare, without any agenda, not having to tell anybody who he was or what he was doing, but just do it like the phrase that we use on occasion, like a white bird in the snow. He's one of the inspirations to me. It's why I love the phrase that we use in practice, no one to be, of learning the freedom of not needing to identify with any part of ourselves, including and especially our spiritual attainment. The bulk of this book, Zen Heart, is really about specifically how to practice within these three phases, clarifying what the three phases are, and hopefully really emphasizing enough that when any one of these phases is downplayed or even worse, when they're ignored, it means that our spiritual practice is going to get in some way short-circuited. So again, the first step in the me phase is becoming free from the attachment of me. The second phase, the phase of being awareness, is about cultivating a larger sense of who we are and of what life is. And the third phase of being kindness is about awakening to the basic kindness or the experience of compassion that we already are. I want to close by just reading one passage from the end of this book, which I think captures the bigger picture of what it is that I'm trying to convey. The real fruit of the practice life is not just about feeling better, nor is it just about having clarity. These things may certainly be included, but the real healing in our spiritual journey is the transformation out of the self-centered life of I as a me. As we come to know the truth of who we really are, that the nature of our being is connectedness and love, we learn to live increasingly from the Zen heart. Our task is not to change ourselves or others, but to know the world through love. Living from being kindness gradually becomes our natural response to life, even in the midst of our all-too-human pain. Our self-judgments of unworthiness and our conditioned fears may not completely disappear, but they no longer dictate who we are or how we live. The lightness of living from the awakened heart, the Zen heart, makes possible a life of increasing joy and appreciation. So this is the overview, and I know you've heard of these three phases before, but maybe perhaps people have questions at this point. Yeah, Paul?
You talk about the lightness of living. To me, one of the heavinesses of modified, fairly strictly me phase has always been this feeling of wanting to feel special, wanting to be special. Is it possible to say something about the notion of nothing special and how that, because I think you were talking about all along the way, that notion, that concept, but it is a specific Zen kind of notion or idea.
It's a specific Zen notion that we have to work with the feeling special. In fact, the whole idea of no one to be is the ultimate freedom that traditional or classic Zen describes. But see, this is true for everybody. It's not just in Zen. Everybody wants to be special in their own way. Some people do it by standing out. Some people will do it by hiding and just having their own inner Walter Mitty fantasy about being special. This is all part of the work of the me phase. And to work with being special means, first, that we have to be able to see it really clearly. And sometimes it's painful to be this honest with ourselves about how much we just want to stand out, or how much we want to just take a crumb of praise and just, you know, hold it and nourish it close to our heart. And really just to see this objectively about ourselves. And then to learn to be able to work with that. Again, this is the work of the me phase of practice. And what does it mean to work with it besides see it? It means that we're willing to experience the fear that's the base of wanting to be special, which is the fear of being no one, the fear of having no identity. And it's a very powerful fear that eventually anybody in practice is going to have to deal with. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Jennifer?
The way you explained referenced visceral experience being more real. And is the way you could explain why that is more real than lost in our thoughts is because visceral experience that it's more inclusive. And so the inclusivity makes it more real, reality based.
Okay, so Jennifer, this is a really difficult question, and I don't want to go off into the philosophical side of it. So let's just talk about experientially. There's a kind of experience we have of reality when we're lost in our thoughts. And you could describe it any number of ways, but if you compare the reality, the inner reality of living out of thinking, including all the emotions that are associated with being caught in our thinking, and then the reality of coming to the physical experience of the present moment, there's a very distinctly different taste of what it is to be alive. And so that in itself is enough to really should be able enough to motivate us to want to live more in this way. But there's more to it than that. Say, being present to the sounds of, like, hearing the plane and feeling my feet on the cushion while I'm talking is one level of being experiencing right now. But it's also possible, by really staying present in this way, to open up into a kind of portal or doorway into a much more expanded sense of what life is, which again is very difficult to explain. We'll never enter into a more expanded sense of reality by just being caught in the mind, no matter how much we want to think about it. And again, this is something that we can experience and taste for ourselves. It's not something that you have to take anybody's word for.
Well, and that was my question, that there's almost really no way to explain it to someone other than having the experience.
You can explain it, but my thought is that you'll just be dealing on a level of thoughts back and forth, and really it's just still going to be caught in the level of mind stuff. And so that's one of the reasons why practice is so difficult, because you can't just get practice by reading it in books, even good books. You can get ideas of what it is we need to do, but you have to work with this yourself. So do you know what I'm talking about, this different experience? Okay. Yeah. Anybody else? Chuck?
So combining the two things that you said, it's kind of interesting. It's not that it's really more or less real. Maybe we should just not even deal with the word real, because that's kind of a loaded word.
Yeah.
Maybe that's kind of loose in there for Jennifer. I mean, I kind of see that in my own intellectual kind of experience with it. It's more like what you were explaining, just that experience. And what do we want to do as we can get that wider, deeper, more inclusive experience? Do we want to go back to being lost in self-centered thinking,
right,
which is maybe just as real as the other thing, right, just in a way of speaking, but the other feels, life is so much different, even if you get a little taste.
Right. It's really interesting that you're bringing this up, because one of the students that came in to Daisan brought this up today too, the exact same viewpoint. And the fact is, our thoughts are real on one level. And so I'm not saying that they're not real. In fact, you could even say that our thoughts and our emotions and our fears and all of this stuff is part of the absolute nature of reality. It's part of the bigger picture of everything. But again, it is just one level of things. So if you look at it, okay, here's the level of our thoughts here, and then there's a bigger experience of reality that includes like the physical experience of life, and that includes maybe being aware of the air and the light and all of that. You could be aware of that, and that'll include this other level of thinking. You don't have to get rid of the thinking. You don't have to obliterate the I. It doesn't have to disappear. But you can be in the I and at the same time have a bigger experience of what life is. And you could say it's more real. They're both real. But when I'm saying it's more real, it's because we're more richly in touch with a sense of the vivacity of being alive, the sense of when we're really in touch with a sense of being, there's a very distinct experience of appreciation or gratitude for being here, which is not really something that when we're caught in self-centered thoughts.
Yeah, the gratitude, and just there can be a real energy in that state too, of just being here with whatever.
Yeah, there can be. I mean, one way to describe this, when we're really here, it's like a kind of a shimmering experience of just really being here, like electricity is going through us. That doesn't happen a lot of the time. Sometimes it's much more mundane than that, but it is distinctly different from being caught in our thoughts, particularly in wanting to be special, and even more particularly than in wanting to be right, which all of us get caught in sometimes.
I want to say one other thing. There's something that Andy Ashanti said that I really liked, and it pertains to the second and the third phases that you were talking about. What he says is that our being is a lover of what is. Simply a lover of what is.
Yeah.
And he goes a step further to say it's an indiscriminate lover of what is.
Yeah.
And we can find ourselves loving someone we don't even particularly like.
Right. Yeah. Well, the nature of love is, the analogy of it is really like the sun. When it shines indiscriminately on everybody. But now we're talking about something that for most of us is we only get in rare glimpses, and most of the time it's far away, but it is good to be reminded that this is the direction that it's going in. Yeah. Anybody else want to raise anything? Yeah, Savita.
I want to just maybe say a little more about this the word inclusive comes up. Because I had this experience a little while ago when I was working there with my loss and all the grief around it, that in a session with my somatic counselor, there was a lot of the story that I had first and the grief was then. And then at some point, he just said, sort of, just very matter of fact, our biology doesn't like loss. And it shifted everything for a moment, and there was just now the body. And,
right.
And I think that's what you were talking about. There is a more inclusive, you still have certain feelings, but it wasn't a suffering feeling anymore.
Right. That's also a good example of using the mind in an intelligent way of kind of understanding, having the clarity of mind that this is the body. Human beings just don't like the discomfort of feeling this. You have that clarity of understanding, it makes it a little less me-centered. And then it allows us, like using the mind like that, then allows us to actually enter into the body. It allows us to leave the mind and enter into the body. So we're not talking about, in the me phase of practice, we're never talking about getting rid of the mind. We're just talking about using it with more clarity and objectivity. Barbara?
Ezra, I really like the story about the taxi driver.
I can't hear you. Just wait 1 second.
I really like the story about the taxi driver.
The who?
The taxi driver.
The taxi driver.
The man who becomes the taxi driver.
Yeah.
The reason I like it is because it sort of makes me think about my own job and how I earn my living, and how to earn my living and live a practice life, which is very challenging. You know, there's this sort of me phase, which I can work with in my job. But I find much harder to do work with being awareness and being kindness in the job. And I just wondered if you could say a bit more about that issue of sort of employment and practice life.
Yeah, this is a difficult area for everybody. who lives 40-hour weeks with busy jobs, of even working on the me phase is sometimes very difficult when we're very busy. The working with the phase of being awareness is a little bit more straightforward, because you could always take timeouts during your job, whether they're just the duration of three breaths, where you have something come up on your computer screen that says, take a pause in time right now, or be here for three breaths, and just feeling what your life is in that moment, to going for walks for, you know, 2 minutes or 10 minutes during lunch or during breaks, and just cultivating it wherever you can. Or just remembering, see, these are all very little things that I'm going to say to you now, but if you're sitting at your desk and you just remember, what does it feel like to have your feet on the floor? What does it feel like to have the pressure of the chair on your buttocks? What does it feel like to have the tension running through your face when you're looking at the computer screen? These are all like little inroads to cultivating being awareness. As far as working on being kindness, which is a little bit more nebulous, but to me, in all of our relationships with other human beings, every single time we have a relationship with another human being, it gives us an opportunity to work on being kindness, if for no other reason, because it allows us to work with every single thing that gets in the way of it. All of our judgments about other people, every time we have a judgment about another person, it's putting a layer between us and our own heart, or the heart of humanity. So we can work on all these things. It just, I know this is sounding like a lot of work and complicated, but we do all of this stuff one step at a time. Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, the way we work with this also is, like with one instance after another, when difficult situations come up, we learn how to work with them as they come up. Yeah. We have time for one more, if anybody else wants to ask one last question, have one last comment, thought. Yeah, Chris, and speak up, okay?
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about when we're faced with a situation that might cause anger or frustration or some type of emotion like that? Why is it, even if our me phase, like you said, those thoughts are on some level reality, they're still real, but if we're approaching it from an eyes awareness viewpoint or part of life, why does that allow us or help us to maybe respond in a better way to those tough situations as opposed to the thought-based, even if it is kind of reality? Does that make sense?
Ask it a little bit, say a little bit more, and maybe you could even give a specific example so I know what you're really getting at.
Well, if, you know, you were just talking about work, so if there's a situation at work that makes you angry.
Right.
And if we are in that thought-based mode, it's likely to just come out as anger. But yeah, if we are able to be in that, maybe being awareness or I as awareness part, maybe there's a little bit less of that allowed out, or maybe you can look at it from a different way or approach it. What is the difference there? How does that actually happen? Or why is that different?
Well, first of all, it's not so easy like you're putting it. We don't just decide I'm going to go from being in the me phase to the phase of I as awareness. If we're angry, we're not even going to think thoughts like that. All we're going to be thinking about is the person who we believe made us angry and why we're right. And so it's why working in the me phase takes a really long time, and it's very difficult because the anger is very much rooted in the body, very often rooted in fears that we have. So it takes a long time of working with not expressing anger to really see the extent of it within ourselves. It takes a lot of going through the actual being angry and dumping it out on other people to really understand how we're poisoning not only ourselves when we do that, but that we're poisoning other people and the environment every time that we express ourselves with the negativity, the negative energy of anger. And at some point when we really start working with it in the me phase, this is a slow process now, Chris, okay? So you don't just jump from having anger in the me phase than to turning it over to I as awareness. It's a slow process of going from I as a me, seeing all the ways we get angry, seeing how we're stuck in fear, residing in that experience and staying with it to the point where we can move to including a bigger sense of self when that angry feeling comes up or the fearful feeling comes up. Remembering in that moment that this is poison and that it would be better, instead of just being believing the thoughts about how right we are, how wrong the other person is, to be able to get in touch with the environment or get in touch with the spaciousness of the heart. It's a gradual movement from the one to the other. Okay, it's not something that just that we just say, okay, I don't want to be here, I want to be here. If spiritual practice was that simple, we'd all be awake right now, and we're not. Okay? So did I answer what you're asking? Okay. Okay. That's enough for today. If any of you have any more questions about this, I hope all of you get to read the book, and I hope you find it helpful, and then as questions come up again, just bring them into Daesung. Thank you.